Galactic K9 Studios. We loosen your leashes, unlatch those cage doors, and distract your handlers to keep a shock collar of statism from being clamped down on your neck.
Yes, yes.
Can you feel it? Is it working? Can you feel it, Michael and Shane?
Yes.
I feel it.
I do.
Excellent. I got all thrown off light where our music is gone. I know he said he was going to do that, but I got all flustered. There's no music. The Freedom Fiends, as always, is covered by a BIPCOT, no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org.
Yeah.
So we're back. Yep. I'm Jeremy. I'm here tonight with Michael, W. Dean, and Shane. What's up, guys?
What's up?
Excellent. Excellent. Wonderful. Digging it. I'm loving the free market. I'm loving the great time it is to be alive. I've, you know, Jeffrey Tucker. You guys know Jeffrey Tucker?
Yes, I do.
Know of him? Yes.
Yeah. Actually, going to get a chance to meet him in a couple of weeks. Pretty excited.
Yes, I'm excited, actually.
Oh, yeah. He's going to be at the, you want to give a little, he's going to be at the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest.
Yes.
Speaking. And then flying in his private helicopter to another speaking engagement the same day.
Is he really? Sure. Sounds good.
Well, I don't know about the, I think he's going to be driving or probably being driven. I don't know.
He doesn't seem like the helicopter type.
No.
Yeah. The helicopters have a weird place in our world because it's a joke that righties, ultra righties, ultra, what are they called?
The alt-right.
Righties.
The
alt-rights make a lot of jokes about throwing leftists out of helicopters because that was something that Pinochet did. And Pinochet was a horrible person. And I don't know. I don't really understand the... I guess the basic premise here... The clearest someone has explained the alt-right idea to me, and this was someone who was not racist. He was more anti-leftist and also anti, you know... I guess kind of, I don't know if it's disguised racism or what, but his basic premise was that this is a street fight, so there are no rules. Basically saying, this theory that tyranny or fascism can create a libertarian paradise. Have you guys heard that one?
Yeah. Right. Yes, we must travel through the pinhole of fascism in order to get to liberty. That's the whole idea.
Is that the phrase?
That was used by a couple of different people. It's been morphed by people on our side to make it a little more less radio friendly.
Hey, you got a mouse in your pocket there?
Yeah. Yes, but you know what I mean, Michael.
I don't know if the audience knows what we mean. So explain what you mean by our side.
I just meant people that don't believe in this insanity of the alt-right and just tossing people all over the place. Forcing their so-called, because there's allegedly libertarians who believe this type of stuff too. Well, that they are allegedly libertarians, right? I should say, who claim to make these things too. And their idea is, in order to get to a libertarian social order, you first must have to pass through the pinhole of fascism. And it's you know, my question, and I think Lou was the first one I heard actually ask somebody this question directly, and it kind of it floored them temporarily. And I was like, oh yeah, that's a really good question. When has that ever worked? When has fascism ever led to liberty?
And I know it's morally wrong. I guess I can see, I don't agree with it, but I can put myself in their shoes and kind of picture the idea. And this freaks people out. Like, libertarians are going to go, oh no, Michael's going. No, I'm not. I'm not going that. But I can picture the idea that, you know, another thing I've heard is basically like, you know, if you're overrun with leftists and they're running the world, or running your country, or running the area you live in, you know, it is hard to get anything done because, you know, you're going to try to have your free market and they're going to try to force you to bake the cake and take your business. So I don't know. It's weird for me because I guess because I don't really, you know, people say, oh, libertarians don't live in the free world or in the real world, you know, but it's like, I don't know the real world in the sense of like running a corporation You know, and I'm not talking about our dog walking businesses and, you know, the one person filmmaking company I had that was an LLC a while back. I'm talking about where you have to have compliance officers and where you have to, you know, prove that you are hiring a certain number of disableds. And I'm a disabled, so I can say that. And, you know, people of color and people of this and that and this and that. I guess I can't really speak what it would be like in those shoes to have to comply with a bunch of government stuff. And there's a fine line, I think, at large levels where you get into millions and billions of dollars, where it's probably really tough to not become someone who's like, oh, we'd had to jump through all those hoops. Okay, now let's get a lobbyist to, you know, pass laws to eliminate the competition. I mean, I'm not being an apologist for that, but I could kind of see how that kind of thing becomes required. And I can kind of try to put myself in the shoes of the other things. But in my world, it's pretty easy to have the purity. And I'm not talking about racial purity. That's not what we're talking about. Bad joke. It's kind of easy to have the purity of saying, yeah, you know, there should be open borders. And that's, you know, but then I can see people who say, well, that's fine and well if it was a true free market, but it's not. It's a welfare paradise. So, you know, clamp down the borders a little bit until you can get things under control, until you're not overrun. I don't know. It's like, if I lived on the border and there were trade wars going on my ranch, you know, I don't know how I'd feel about open borders. It's pretty easy for me to say in Wyoming, which is a state where it's pretty hard to be a leftist and there's really no inner city. Well, there's one inner city. It's in Cheyenne, and that's far away from me. So, you know, I'm kind of living in the world that a lot of those people want to use the pinhole of fascism to get to. You know, I live in a world where it's not the problems I had when I lived in San Francisco and when I lived in Los Angeles. So, anyway, I was going to get back to Jeffrey Tucker, but do you guys have anything to say about this? I mean, do you ever look at from the other side, from the other viewpoint, or do you just...
Oh, sure.
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, well, yeah? Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I have a bunch I could say on it. This was that would actually tie into the topic I wanted to talk about later. I thought we wanted to talk
about... We're short on notes. Go ahead. Oh. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely try to view as many, you know, both or as many sides of every position as I can. Otherwise, I run the risk of becoming too dogmatic. I know that from my own experiences that it's, you know, I try to look at everything. I always cringe when this topic starts to come up to begin with, because the it becomes this very rigid split between open borders and closed borders, and people are lumped into one side or the other. And for myself in particular, I've never once advocated for open borders, even though I personally get accused of it all the time.
I thought you were doing that today on Facebook. It looked like you were.
No, I know. I word my things very specifically, and it throws people off sometimes who aren't paying attention. I'm not saying that that's you, but a lot of people attack me because they think of what I'm saying. I've never once advocated for open borders. I have always advocated for the end of all political borders, which to me is a difference, because I believe that things would be solved if you privatized everything, right. Which is also a relatively consistent libertarian position, that privatizing pretty much everything would solve so many problems, because property disputes are, you know, you could solve property disputes so much easier that way. And, you know, so I don't advocate for open borders, but I also have a problem with more money being dumped into clamping down on the borders, as some of these people would like, because in theory, a lot of these arguments, like you were saying, you can see that side of the argument. I can see it too, sure. And in theory, a lot of it makes sense. However, if you actually look at the reality of the situation and the history of the situation, anytime the government claims it is using money for a specific purpose, you can almost guarantee that that money is going to be wasted beyond belief and is never actually going to go to the specific purpose it is intended to. That's
what are
not
you talking
how
about
government...
What are you talking about? I agree, but in this situation, what are you talking about in particular?
Because they want to clamp down on the people, you know, people that make this argument for the very, you know, the very tightly closed borders, want to clamp down on border security so people can't come in. They want to restrict access by you know, part of the argument I got into with somebody today was about, you know, or the other day actually, was about eliminating all visas for the time being. So nobody can come into the, pretty much nobody can come into the country as anything other than a tourist. You know, so it's like they want to clamp down on all of this stuff. And I'm like, okay, again, in theory, sounds great. However, in practice, there's a reason that this stuff never stops, even when government is supposedly clamping down on these things, because the special interests that actually run most of Washington want certain people coming in for certain reasons.
Google wants, and I like Google, and I'm going to talk great later about how Google is great. And what I was getting around to is Google is, to me, suddenly, it always has been something pretty cool to me, but lately it's become kind of, to me, what McDonald's is to Jeffrey Tucker. You know, in that it's the thing that I just want to sing the praises of and really think that a lot of what Google does is, even though they're heavily regulated in every area and they're a huge multinational corporation and they've done a few sleazy things in the past, but they've kind of cleaned up their hand with a lot of that too. But I really think they're how you replace government. I think that that kind of, the way that company's run, even though they, you know, even though they are really lefty and they're like, yes, we are diversified and we're helping women learn to program. They had this thing the other day that was almost, it was insulting. It was like, you know, there's this, they've gotten, a lot of tech companies in Silicon Valley have gotten in trouble because there's way more male programmers than female programmers. Well, men tend to go into science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM things more than women. Women tend to go to more humanities, you know, underwater, what you'd call your underwater basket weaving and your, you know, feminist dance therapy degrees. That's kind of an exaggeration, but it's kind of not. I mean, my sister, who is an inveterate liberal, has a doctorate from an Ivy League university in social work, and she's unemployed. I mean, you know, and if you're a good programmer, even without a degree, you can get a job in Silicon Valley. But they did this thing where they were like, women, learn to program. And it was the front thing, the Google Doodle. And you click on it. It's like this little thing that shows you how to, like, it was a little puzzle. You pull things around and then it says you hit the button and it compiles. And you're not really programming. It's not teaching programming. But it made women be able to say, I'm a programmer. I'm helping.
Worms.
But I love Google, regardless, worms, and we will be back. Worms.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
The Michigan Peace and Liberty Coalition is proud to present the 5th Annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest. It will be held at the Circle Pine Center in Delton, Michigan, just outside of Kalamazoo, starting Thursday, June 22nd, and going through Monday, June 26th. That's right, Liberty Fest is getting longer and stronger. There will be presentations, discussions, bacon duels, and outdoor activities in an environment that is both family and grown-up friendly. There will be special appearances by Jeffrey Tucker, Dana Martin, and a few of the Freedom Fiends. If you have only talked about what a free society would look like, this is your chance to live it and see it with your own eyes. Now round up your friends and family and get them registered today at mplfest.org. And there's a discount for paying with Bitcoin. That's mplfest.org. Dogs welcome. Longer leashes recommended.
A little song I wrote called Wood Guitar and Feather a Tax Collector that's playing in the background.
Probably the greatest name of a song ever.
It is a pretty funny name. It pushes buttons. That's the song that got me called a terrorist. Yeah.
I actually wrote
that right after. Do you remember when first term of Obama, a census worker was found dead with the word Fed written on his chest in magic marker. Do you remember that?
No.
I really thought it was a false flag, but it was, it happened. It was in the South somewhere. Yep. Fed. I really thought, like, that was the first shot in the, you know, second Civil War in America. I thought that was going to escalate, but I don't think it did.
I can imagine why you would think that. That must have slipped. I still wasn't woke back then, so it might have slipped under my radar. But that's something that, especially in my early days of figuring all this stuff out, that would have immediately jumped out at me. Like, I would have had, like, my conspiracy mind would have kicked into high gear, and I just would have been like, oh my God, it's coming, we're all gonna die.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I could totally see that.
Yep. Yep, and you know what I say to that?
Don't try this at home.
Yes,
there you go. That's Pocket Alibi. You can get Pocket Alibi too. It's a free Android app, and it's a soundboard with hundreds of sayings that are good for breaking the ice at parties or disclaimers.
May cause triggering.
Yeah.
You should never do the thing I'm talking about.
Yep. Don't tar and feather a tax collector. Allegedly. So. Not a guarantee. So we're going to talk more about the thing we kind of teased. We kind of got off into a tangent, and I said during the break, do we need to tie this back up? Because that's how you do good radio, and people who want to do radio or podcasts or even write stories or tell stories drunkenly around a campfire at the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest. I don't say pork. I almost said Pork Fest, but I'm like, no, nobody goes to Pork Fest anymore. I've actually seen people saying, like, you going to Pork Fest? It's going to be a lot less crowded this year. I'm psyched. Seriously. Which is like saying, yeah, no one goes to that anymore because it's no longer cool because they threw Ian Freeman under their bus for something he'd said 10 years earlier that they'd known about the whole time, and then they threw him under the bus finally when the Koch brothers kind of took over the whole thing and didn't want to be associated with that guy who had brought thousands of people into the Free State Project. Humans. Yeah. So
Ian probably brought like at least half of the 20,000 himself.
The alleged 20,000. I don't really know that there's, 20,000 people pledged, but I don't think those are 20,000 people that intend to move. Because
I'm one of those people.
For instance, yeah, my wife and I are two of those people, and we bought a house in Wyoming and love it. We dig it here. So, I want to talk about Google. I want to talk about the free market. And I want to talk about how things are. What's that?
So let's talk Google. Like I said, we can get back to that. We will tie that other thing up. We can tie it up later because that was the plan.
That was the plan during the break, and we're sticking to the plan.
So
we said Google. Unless the plan was unclear. Although, hey, I could talk a long segment about Google if you want to.
That's fine. Yeah, we can talk about something else first. We have a couple long segments. But Google, so where were we? Google's gonna replace government, right? That's where we're.
Yeah, Google's gonna Google. You know, I think could do a lot of things. You know, people always say the blockchain will solve everything, and the blockchains are doing a lot of things. The blockchains, for those who don't know, listening on radio at home, are technologies for sharing information that are commonly used. Bitcoin was the first use in the sense. Actually, the blockchains existed before that, but not in the sense that Bitcoin, in the sense that, it was a decentralized ledger where people could make entries that required certain things to make an entry that could not be double spent or faked. That's the thing. Really, when it comes down to it, that's what a blockchain is in the cryptocurrency sense. And that's what's amazing about it, is that it's a publicly shared ledger that you can add information to, like, for instance, pay into it or take out of it. And you can't just make more fake entries on it. You cannot, make coins that aren't there. And that's a misunderstanding for a lot of people. There's a lot of people that go like, oh, man, that's not real money. It's not backed by anything. I'm into gold. Well, check this out. If you'd spent $10,000 on gold and $10,000 on Bitcoin 5 years ago, your $10,000 of gold worth of gold would now be worth $9,900, and your $10,000 worth of Bitcoin would be worth $300 million. And you could say that's not backed by anything, but you can buy houses and cars and land and anything you want and gold with that money. There are many sites online that take Bitcoin for gold. So if you're still stuck in the 200 ADs, meow. Gold's still useful. No, I'm not against gold. It's just not. People who love gold and hate blockchains are ridiculous at this point.
Worms.
It's like the internet. There's nothing there. It's just ones and zeros.
You and the hamster tubes. Listening to.
Yeah. And worms. Worms and zeros.
Worms and zeros.
Meow.
And there existed stickers. They used to not exist. Now they exist.
That's funny. DJ, how do you like the fiend stickers on our coffee pot?
They're gorgeous.
Yes. What do they say?
State speech is hate speech. And BIPCOT. .org.
Yeah, and people can get them by going to freedomfiends.com and clicking on the new link at the top. It says stickers, and there will be more designs. So check back regularly. Catch them all.
Worms.
Well,
I don't care if Google reads all my emails. I have nothing to hide.
I don't know. It's kind of like getting to the point where if you want all the nifty fun stuff, you have to submit to the Borg. But I'd rather submit to the Borg of Google than the Borg of the government. And I'm reading what it takes for Google to turn information over to the government, and it's they don't just hand it over. Some companies just hand it over. They will honor a subpoena, which is not court ordered. It's just a cop, basically, or a detective saying, send me stuff. But with a subpoena, they'll give very little. They'll give you, like, the name, the real name associated that was, well, the name that was used to sign up with the account, the IP address that signs in with it. Not a lot. You know, to really get down in it, they need a, they need a subpoena, or they need a warrant, which is pretty cool. I mean, you know, the really cool thing would be to not arm them. I mean, not honor them. You know, I was actually thinking, I saw this meme a while back that said, you know, Google mottos throughout the ages. And it was like, you know, 1999, don't be evil. And that was Google's motto. And then it said, like, you know, 2006, evil is hard to define, which, <Yeah. laughs> and then it said, like, you know, 2014, we make robots for the military. But yeah. They actually sold the company that makes the robots for the military. And my theory is this, that they were making robots to sell to the military to finance their robot making company to build their own private Skynet. I think Google is building an army to the point where they can just say, government regulations. What? No, we have our own robot army. Maybe. But you know, it kind of reminds me of like in 1970s, there was a lot of sci-fi that took place in the not too distant future, i.e. now, where governments were kind of usually replaced with like one or two mega corporations that ran everything in the world.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of those? Like Rollerball was one of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and they were always companies that mainly manufactured hardware things, and Google does manufacture hardware things, but I kind of think those two companies are going to be Google and Amazon because they're doing so much useful in the world. They're making great things. They're wonderful products. Wonderful. They're wonderful. They're huge. They're going to be huge.
Huge.
Couple things that I've heard about recently that Google's doing. One is a lot of times what they do is buy companies and then turn the technology into something really useful. Like Google didn't even invent Android. They bought the company from two guys who started it, and it was really small and not many people were using it, and they bought it for like $100 million or $50 million, I think it was, and then, you know, made it really, really workable to where it's running, you know, over half the, like, two-thirds of the phones in the world, and it's free. And a lot of what they're doing too is giving things away to crush the competition, which I really like, and it's something that, like, governments try to regulate. And somehow, I don't know if, I mean, I'm not saying Google's bribing people, but somehow they're too big to, they can't be stopped is what it is somehow. But I mean, they're doing things like they bought a company that makes smart contact lenses, and they're working on that. And like some of the uses of these would be a contact lens that would have sensors in it that can see what you're looking at and could start filming video if you blink twice. You know, so it's like,
wow.
You know, you can film the cops without the cops knowing you're filming the cops. Another thing is it could automatically adjust in real time constantly, so you have ultra great vision at any distance, which I'm all for because I have two pair of glasses, one for reading and one for TV and driving. And I'm always leaving one or the other in the other room. You know, I'm like, I'm watching TV. I come in wearing my TV glasses. I set them down. I pick up my computer glasses, do something on the computer, and go back. And almost every time I forget my TV glasses. And I'm like, Google, take me away. You know, let me experiment on me. But other things it could do are, it could have sensors in it that would, like, if you're diabetic, you wouldn't need to stick your finger. It would just tell whether your blood sugar is low or not. All sorts of cool uses that, you know, if the government were making that, well, first of all, the government would use it to spy on everybody, and they probably, you know, will find a way to. They'll probably hack your eyes, but...
Hack your eyes.
Hack. There's the show title right there. Hacking your eyes. yeah, but the other thing that they're doing is really exciting to me is Google Drive, Google Docs, and Chromebooks. Do you guys use any of those things?
I have used, I've used Google Drive a couple of times. I do use Google Docs. There's a couple of projects I've worked on with people where it's been, you know, just so much easier just to send
collaborative.
And, you send it back and forth to one
another. Word processing or spreadsheets?
Word processing mostly.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, you can send back and forth, and you can, you know, everybody can do edits to it, like pretty much right there, right then and there. And then it gets, you know, the next time you open it up, boom, there the edits are, you know, if even if, you know, so even if Joe did it over there, it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So they've basically solved a bunch of problems that have plagued me and bugged me about writing on computers since. Really, since I started writing on computers, which was 25 years ago, I think it was, actually I started writing on computers in 1991, but that was not a computer, it was connected to the internet. I first got on the internet at home in 1996, 106, 116, so 21 years that I've been writing and back and like backing things up on the internet, because I actually know of people who've written a novel and then like their laptop gets ripped off and they've lost the novel, you know, or, you know, people who like their house has gotten, you know, like they had a fire in their house and they copiously backed it up onto discs or, you know, CDs or USB drives. This is before USB drives. You know, and then there's a fire in their apartment and it destroys the backups also. What I used to do, you know, and I've done some writing for a living. You know, I've written a book that sold 100,000 copies. It was, you know, $30 retail books. So I've sold $3 million plus worth of retail worth of books, and then written some other books that were less commercially successful, including some other tech books. And then also self-published a novel before you could do it online. Like I actually had to do the page layout in Quark and then take the files to a printing company that print and bound the books in Oakland, a company called Punks with Presses for my first book in 2001. And I've always been writing, and I haven't written a book in 7 years. The last book I wrote was this book called A User's Manual for the Human Experience, which is kind of a time management / self-help book. It's the first half of the book is about getting bad people, toxic people out of your life, recognizing them and learning to get them out as painlessly as possible and keep them out or minimize them. It's before I ever heard the word defoo. I mean, it was basically about how to defoo people, but it wasn't based on, oh, they voted. You know, it was more like, oh, they wreck your life. And then the second half of the book is all about, you know, basically how to make a living doing stuff you like to do, which I've done a good bit of in my life. And, you know, in all fields, like in, you know, music as a professional musician, signed to Warner Brothers, writer, you know, made some money writing, you know, published by the biggest, $30 Film School was published by the biggest school book, you know, textbook writer in America, Course Technology. And then, you know, made some films, did a film that's narrated by Robert Downey Jr., got, you know, worldwide distribution for them back when DVD was a thing. You know, never made a lot of money at any of this stuff, but made enough money to keep going and doing stuff for since 2001, basically. So I've always been writing, and I haven't written in a long time, and I've started writing another book. I'm writing a book called The 4.5 Rules of Life. And it's kind of the sequel to a user's manual for the human experience. And I'm really digging it. And, oh, first of all, this is really funny. So my last book was self-published, but I was like, and it did pretty well. Like there's, you know, I sold a bunch of copies online. I still sell copies online, physical copies of it, paperbacks. And I'm also making a Kindle version of that. People have always asked for a Kindle version. There's an audiobook, but there's no Kindle version. I'm finally making one of those because it's easy to do in Google Docs for free. And, you know, a lot of these companies too, like Amazon and Google, they're working with what's called the long tail. Do you know what the long tail means? It's not your cat. It's not my cat.
What is the long tail, Michael?
Yeah, I don't know that phrase.
It is, it's a phrase of marketing. So if you picture a graph, somebody wrote a book on this like 15 years ago and it changed Silicon Valley and it really influenced a lot of these companies. So like when Amazon started, you know, they only took published books by big publishers. And when Google started doing apps, at first they only had apps by, you know, big companies or whatever. And then they immediately opened it up. Google shortly after and Amazon a while after, because it was earlier, started taking books, self-published books by anybody. And, you know, Google books, you know, like Google will take apps by anybody and make it really easy for the process to add them. So if you look at on a chart, like let's say in the music industry. So, all the stuff on major labels that sells hundreds of thousands and millions of copies, that's like a big high peak, a big sharp high peak of sales on the chart. And it's a really small percentage of the artists do that. And then you've got like a big swooping, like kind of hockey stick going down. That's all of the other people that, you know, sell 5,000 copies or 2,000 copies or 50 copies. That's the long tail of sales. And, you know, it's the people who are not famous who self-publish stuff in music, films, in music and apps and books. The long tail all added together is more money than the rock stars make for the companies. So, you know, the internet made it possible to do that. Like, you know, I used to put out records in, you know, the 80s. Like we would, you know, go into a studio, pay for it ourselves, and, you know, press vinyl copies out of our money and work day jobs and construction and, you know, paid drug testing, being a lab rat to make. I did that. I was a lab rat to put out our first record. And, you know, it was really hard to distribute too. Like we had to, you know, call up on the phone when it costs money to make a phone call for every long distance phone call on a landline. And we'd call people in New York City and try to get them to call us back and say, you've never heard us. Well, we're this band called Baby Opaque and this band called Bomb. And, you know, will you take 50 of these on consignment? And they would. And sometimes they'd go out of business and you'd have to ship them. You'd have to go to a post office, you know, cost money to ship them. You'd lose money when they went out of business. But with digital stuff, like, it's really easy for companies, meow, to take that stuff. So the long tail. Freedom Fiends are a cat with a long tail. We'll be back.
Meow. Yeah.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Scheduling, how the heck does it work? All right, so yeah, you're on Day After Tomorrow, Shane. Cool. So, I'll talk about how I'm singing the praises of Google as an example of how the free market works, or as free as it can be. You know, I mean, all these companies have to follow some government regulation, but you know, they don't do it that much. I remember one time Google turned down a demand. The U.S. government said, this was like 5 years ago when there's a lot less web traffic, and they said that they demanded that Google give them all the web searches, Google searches, for 1 week for the United States. That was their demand. And Google was like, nope. And, you know, like I say, I think Google's building a robot army, so eventually they'll be like, heck no. But so they've solved some problems that I've been having with writing for a long time. Basically, how to easily write, back stuff up, and have a really, really portable laptop. I remember touring with my film DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist in Europe in 2004. And I had a laptop with me because I was writing $30 music school while I was touring. And there's something really cool about like writing a book and then writing another book and using the same agent and the same publisher where like the book is guaranteed to be published. I've had that happen twice. I've actually had three books that I was like had a, you know, was being paid to write and then would get royalties for. And then one of them actually like the company, like that division went out of business and they tried to hold my book hostage because they'd paid money for it, to like work on it. And we had to like threaten to sue them, have our agent threaten to sue them to get our book back so we could self-publish it. But other than that, like two other times, like it's really fun writing a book when you know it's going to be published by a publisher. But I'm not going to go with a publisher for this. I probably could. I've dealt with agents. I have, you know, ins in that world, but I want to be able to self-publish this again because I want to be able to use the BIPCOT no government license and I want to have complete control. And a lot of people say, I don't want some editor telling me what to do, but there are people that really kind of need an editor. I don't need an editor. I'm really good at making something that works, a long form thing. But so I remember I was in Ireland one night and I was walking, like I was trying to find the place I was staying, and it was this really kind of scary neighborhood. And I was like walking with like a $900 laptop in my book bag that weighed like 6 pounds, you know? So it's like really heavy. And I'm walking around just thinking like, am I going to get killed? And is this going to get stolen? And, you know, haven't backed the book up today. I used to back things up by like Gmailing them to myself and leaving them on Gmail on the servers or even on Yahoo before that. But, and I used to do things like burn DVDs of backups and keep them in my car. So if my house got broken into or stolen, they'd still be in my trunk of my crappy car that no one in their right mind would have stolen at that point. But so what Google has done is they've come up with this thing called Google Drive and Google Docs, where basically you write a document using software that's similar to Microsoft Word 10 years ago before it had all the bells and whistles that kind of made it not as good. Like it's so, there's too much in it now.
It's the stripped down much better version.
And you're basically writing it on their servers, but it's really quick and it updates immediately. It feels like you're writing it on your end, and it saves it like every time you pause, it saves it. And so, and they've also made this thing called a Chromebook, which costs, you know, like I ordered one that's $60, that's 60. It's a used one that cost $250 when it came out, and it's still in good shape. And it weighs like 2.2 pounds. So I could travel with this thing. It's light. I could carry it. And if somebody mugged me in a crappy neighborhood in Dublin, you know, it wouldn't matter. If it's a password on it, I could just go somewhere else and change the password on my Gmail account immediately. And, you know, all my stuff's backed up. I'm still going to download it like once a week and save a copy of it. Even though I've never heard of like Google, you know, losing people's documents. I've heard of them getting hacked and other people being able to see them, but that's rare and it was a long time ago and they've solved it. I also made like a new Gmail address to do it. So, you know, if somebody wanted to hack my stuff, they'd probably go after the Gmail address they knew, you know, but it's easy to just make another one. They give you like gigs and gigs and gigs of backup. I just really dig it. And I also think that Emailer Miller should use one even though he's on an iPhone, because he complains about like not being able to, you know, add things he wants to add because all his memes are on his phone. Meow. He could have all his memes in the cloud, and Google's wonderful, and it's the free market and the long tail. All hail the long tail. There's your show title, Jeremy.
Yeah, that's much better.
All hail the long tail.
Yep.
Meow.
And well, here's a picture of a cat with a long tail.
Worms.
Yeah, worms. When we get back, other people will talk than me.
Allegedly.
Someone other than me will allegedly talk. Yeah.
Not a guarantee.
Damn.
Cell 411 is a free app for Android and iOS that replaces government-controlled 911. Cell 411 allows you to preset a group of friends or private organizations to show up in any emergency. Cell 411 is a nightmare for the state because it proves their so-called services aren't needed. Cell 411 has had thousands of installs, and of course it's covered by the BIPCOT No Government License. Cell 411 because your friends won't shoot you when you're in trouble. Without the government, who would build the emergency services? You and Cell 411. Get it today at GetCell411.com. That's GetCell411.com.
Welcome back to the Freedom Fiends. Broadcasting through the Libertarian Reeducation Center's Low Orbit Ion Cannon, high atop Financial Beast Plaza on the artificial satellite LibPair 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region. As always, the Freedom Fiends is covered by the BIPCOT No Government License. This allows reuse by anyone except governments and government agents. To learn more about this, go to BIPCOT.org.
Worms. So we're back for the second hour, and Michael stepped away for a little while, but we're still here. I'm Jeremy. That's Shane. What's up, man?
Hi.
So we spent most of the first hour. Well, I was about to say we spent most of the first hour talking about Google and Amazon and stuff like that, but more accurately, Shane and I sat and listened to Michael talk about Google and Amazon extensively in the first hour and how they're going to either save the world or destroy us all. But either way, it looks like it's going to be a pretty cool ride. But I think we'll switch gears a little bit here. And I don't know if you got a chance to read this. I think I sent this story late, Shane, but I'm sure you could speak about it, at least even if you haven't read it. But there, Puerto Rico, the entity known as the landmass with the government known as Puerto Rico, recently voted yes to join the they're trying to get statehood. they don't want to be a territory anymore. They want to, and I know this stuff has come up before in the past, and but it was funny. They're like, I read this and they're making a big deal about it. So it's overwhelming. It was like that 99% of the voters, or 90, some ridiculously high number like that, all voted in favor, except only 23% of the voting population turned out. So yeah. Remember with the there was a big thing with the recent U.S. election where it was the 46.9% that didn't vote,
silent majority.
Yes, the silent majority, yeah. Where a lot of small L libertarians and anarchists were taking to that to say, oh, look at all these people that aren't voting. We're winning. We're getting there. It's like, well, no, people just may be apathetic. It may not be that they're finding freedom and liberty and wanting to actually, make a statement about the fact that they're not voting. But this is even more, like 23%.
Yeah, so it's like even smaller slice.
Exactly. So, and it seems that, according to the story, and I've read a couple other things too, it seems there was a lot of opposition to this, and the opposition parties, a lot of them boycotted the elections altogether. And that's a pretty, I obviously am not going to speak as an expert on the inner workings of Puerto Rican politics and how things normally go down there. But I can assume, I can imagine based on, governments around the rest of the world. But the fact that that many people were against being part of the United States, which, allegedly, also tying back into something we started talking about in the first hour with like the whole immigration debate and all that stuff about how many people are allegedly wanting to be part of the United States and want to come to the U.S. and all this stuff, that many people would be opposed. And a lot of those parties, some of them wanted to keep the way they are, where they're still like a U.S. territory and they get some kind of tax benefits from doing that, like they get some kind of money, right. So I don't know how that exactly works with Puerto Rico. I know they don't get they don't get a share of the taxes the way the rest of the states do, because they're not an official state. Some of the opposition wanted to remain remain the way things are, but there was a lot of the opposition that actually wanted to become an independent nation, which to me, I mean, obviously I think the ideas of nations are silly, but that to me is a step in the right direction, at least, because that's a, you know, if you want to look at it from a secessionist position.
Right.
And, you know, that's what they would be doing by declaring their independence. I think that's a great thing. So that kind of excited me to see that there was that many people in Puerto Rico that were thinking along those lines. What do you think about all that?
Well, I think in this particular case, it seems like they're only given the two options. And the one option, which would be to become independent. And, that's a baby step in the right direction. But I think a lot of those people who are supporting joining the United States better be careful what they wish for, because it could end up being like Hotel California. You know, once you, how does the line go?
I'm gonna forget it right now. I try to tune that song out. I hate that song. It drives me up a wall. I've heard it so many times.
But you can never leave.
Yeah. You can check in
anytime you like, but you can never leave. Yeah. And if they're not careful, that's what they can end up with. You know, they better be careful what they wish for, because if they become a state, they might not be able to leave at that point.
Well, yeah, because, you know, speaking of secession, that's a dirty word in American politics. Unfortunately, it's considered a dirty word. But yeah, you look at the history of secession here, which of course always makes me laugh, because so many people that are vehemently anti-secession, they think that that's an abhorrent idea. Oh my God, how dare you want to leave the U.S. and so many times in the past when I've brought that up depending on the company I was in, automatically labeled that one term that always makes me laugh, because I think of the interview with a zombie with Tom Woods and Robert Murphy, but neo-Confederate, you can think of secession, but it's like these people, most of these people that are so vehemently against it, of course, are completely oblivious to the fact that, well, it's like, how was the United States created originally? Wasn't it a secession? Why is this such a bad thing? It's been proven out that secessionist movements never go very well, because normally, I mean, here in the States they always get squashed, because the last time it tried to happen in en masse was, well, the not so civil war happened after that, and any movements since then have not really gained any significant traction. I mean, I guess whatever they were trying to do in California right after the election had, like, you know, that the Cal exit thing, which I haven't heard anything about in a month or two or more at this point.
Even Brexit might be dead in the water, even though they voted to leave. They still have all these hoops they have to jump through and red tape that might keep them.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
Doing so. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw something. I think I saw our former co-host, Jim Jesus, mentioned something about that. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. They didn't actually. Everybody was like, oh, yeah, we have it. It's like, well, no, not officially. Not yet.
Yeah, there's still all kinds of red tape that they got to go through, and they might not be able to even make it work.
Well, yeah, so that's why, like I said, I don't know the inner workings of Puerto Rican politics, and I don't, you know, I'm not going to pretend to know what people are thinking down there and stuff like that. But it was, you know, there were three options on that referendum, not just two. Uh-huh. There was the option to keep things the way they are, vote to become a state, or vote to become an independent nation.
Oh, okay.
So there was at least those third options. And like I said, there were some of the opposition, some of the people that boycotted were the ones that wanted to keep the status quo. Yeah. But a larger number seemed to be the ones that were looking to become independent. And again, you know, sure, new country forms officially and has a, you know, they may increase their government, or they may do something else, and now they have their own little nation state, which, historically speaking, doesn't bode well for liberty. However, getting out from under the you know, the so-called protections of a bigger entity like the United States. Well, to me, that always seems like a move in a positive direction. That's why even, you know, same thing with Great Britain. You know, it was like, okay, great. Mm-hmm. You're gonna have your own little crazy parliamentary system still, but you don't want to be part of the European Union anymore. Excellent. You know, same thing with the Scottish independence that they kept trying to do when they were trying to break away. You know, it's like, okay, I'm sure there are not, and I think we actually had some conversations this was actually pre my time on the Fiends, but back when the Greens were still on here, they talked about it, you know, how it's like, mm-hmm. yeah, there's not necessarily a lot of libertarian sentiment necessarily, but they still want freedom from the major oppressors in their lives, which again is a step in the positive direction. So, right.
And I do know some people from Puerto Rico who live there, and they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place because they don't have a lot of the I dare say privileges of having your own, you know, state or nation, but they also have to be like connected to the United States. So they have to follow a lot of our like laws and regulations, but they don't get a lot of the benefits of being part of the country either. And then they also can't turn around and do things that they could do if they were independent. So I think that's why a lot of them support going one way or the other rather than keeping the status quo.
Yeah. And that makes sense. And I can totally understand that because that's got to be frustrating as all get out, you know, mm-hmm. especially if you're somebody who is not necessarily from an anarchist perspective in the first place. And, you know, you're one of those people who just looks at it like, well, government's going to be necessary, but we'd much rather have. Is that Michael coming back? I hear him in the back quietly.
I don't know if that's a board op or if that's Michael in the background.
No, that definitely sounded like Michael. So we, now I lost my train of thought. I was just saying, if they're not necessarily coming from an anarchist perspective, that, you know, they're coming from a perspective of government's necessary. Right. But we'd still rather have more control over it, at least, which again is more pro freedom than not. So it's a good thing, right. I think, and that kind of excited me.
Yeah, the people that I know that are supporting one or the other aren't doing so for libertarian reasons, but they should.
Yeah. Now, so, and of course, this whole thing doesn't mean anything because the Congress and stuff has to vote on this too, to decide whether to allow Puerto Rico to become in. And their economy is so messed up down there too right now, and things are not. From what I've heard, things are not very not going particularly well down there at the moment, and haven't been for quite a while. So, although you know, what can you expect? Because they've technically been a territory of the U.S. for how many years at this point?
Right. I think I heard something about them wanting their own currency, but not being unable to do so because they have to use the dollar.
Well, yes, exactly. Right there. A huge point for exactly what you were just talking about. You know, you can't see cryptocurrency should be coming big down there. I wonder if anybody's working on the Bitcoin market in Puerto Rico. We should find out.
Yeah.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone proof.
There. This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. Purse.io is a great website where you can spend Bitcoin on Amazon or trade Amazon gift cards for Bitcoin. I use Purse myself and I love it. You can also get discounts on Amazon. You can get 5% right this minute, or if you place your order and wait a day or so, you can name your discount and get 10%, 20%, even up to 33% off. You can try Purse right now and get 0.01 Bitcoin free after you complete your first order over $50. And if you go through the Freedom Fiends link, Purse will also send 0.01 Bitcoin to the Freedom Fiends. Help yourself to some agorism and help Liberty Media while you're at it. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the Purse link, even if you've used Purse before. Or enter the referral code FIENDS when you sign up at purse.io. That's FIENDS. Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra. Do it!
Well. break snuck up on me. I wanted to clear my throat before we started the next second. Oh, I hear music. That's not good. My cursor is not in place. I got this whole big mess on my table right now because I got both the BipTots decided to stay tonight, which is a very rare thing on a Sunday night. So like I got the monitor on my top of my laptop so I can see them to make sure everything's okay up there. And it's like in the way, so I'm trying to like typing is not even really possible on the laptop that I use FiendPhone on. So it's just all sorts of
multitasking extraordinaire.
Yeah, well, you know, I got to play dad every once in a while. So
yeah,
any hoodle. So we were talking about Puerto Rico in the last segment, and we'll switch gears in this one. I had another story I found on FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education, which is one of my favorite sites to check out regularly. And this is actually a topic I think we've talked about recently. I'm pretty sure Phil and I actually talked about this recently, business licensure and stuff like that. It might have been Phil, Lou, and I. But this story in particular just made me laugh because the headline is an Idaho makeup artist just got the best revenge. And this is basically a story of, you know, this makeup artist who's been in the business for over 20 years. And she's actually worked with a lot of celebrities and even politicians and stuff like that. And she was recently hit up for work by, you know, somebody said, oh, I want your services. And it was the governor's wife, the governor of Idaho's wife, who she's actually done work with in the past, according to the article. But she said no because the hairdresser, the makeup artist, or sorry, said no because the governor had vetoed reform for the cosmetology industry that would have exempted artists like this woman from state regulations. And then his wife has pretty much the audacity a few months later to turn around and be like, hey, would you like to do work for me? It's like, and she's like, no, sorry, you know, it was apparently that she wasn't actually contacted directly they actually refer to her as the first lady of the state in here, which is just so like, I just saw that made me cringe. I was like, really, really? They actually do that? Yeah. They actually call governor's wives the first
ladies?
Yeah,
governor's wives are known as first ladies.
Oh, that's just, that's abhorrent. Like, come on. What, really, people? The titles of nobility, seriously? You don't, like, you don't see the problem here? Anyway, let me get off on that tangent. But I just thought this was hysterical because it's like she got to like stick it in their faces. And I mean, you know, she said, she's been in this, and like, again, this is a woman who may not necessarily be libertarian at all, or you know, may not be thinking in an anarchist framework. But just the things that she says, like some of the stuff she's quoted in here, the fact that that there's a proposal to ever since the original legislation was vetoed, they try to get more, you know, some of the politicians try to get more stuff through, and they were just like, well, we want to create licenses for these people so they can do this stuff, and you know, and they're, you know, with 250 hours of training essentially, and this woman's like, this is insane. Like, where did they pick this number out of? Like, did they just pick that number out of a hat? Like, did they have any idea how this works? Like, I've been doing, because again, this is somebody who's been doing this for over 20 years, has like a, you know, a pretty decent laundry list of high level clientele,
right?
And so is obviously well trusted, and people like her, you know, love the services and stuff that she provides. Why should she need to be licensed or get a permit? And like, why should she have to pay any type of money in order to justify herself to the politicians that she has the, you know, the requisite training now, like that, like, and that she hits on that by saying that, you know? So it's like,
yeah,
these ideas are out there. I, you know, I guess for a lot of people, they haven't quite connected the dots yet, but You know, like I said, on multiple levels, this story struck my fancy because, you know, getting to tell a politician or, you know, a politician's wife, I guess, is the next best thing.
Right. I thought it was ironic that either the secretary or the first lady herself, you know, had approached her for the services and that she had to tell them that she declined because, no, I'm sorry, I can't, because your husband didn't sign the legislation that would have allowed me to do so. I thought that was really funny.
Yeah, yeah. She said she, you know, she tried to be polite. She tried to be polite about it, but she was like, yeah, this is an opportunity to really kind of like stick it to him. It's like, hey, not for nothing, you know, I know. Yeah, because, and it was like, I think it said it was passed between a third party, so it wasn't like direct contact right. between the quote-unquote first lady and this woman, but it was basically, you know, hey, I know we've worked together in the past, but just a reminder, your husband just tried to destroy my career for no reason, but hey, thanks for asking.
Yep.
Worms.
Politicians setting these arbitrary...
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've run websites since 1996 and have used over a dozen web hosts in that time. AgristHosting.com is the only one that hasn't broken my heart. Agrist Hosting's uptime and service is stellar, and their DDoS mitigation is the best I've seen. That's important because if you tell the truth in this world, you'll ruffle feathers. And some people will try dirty tricks to silence your voice. No matter what the haters hit us with, Agorist Hosting keeps our websites online. If you have a mission-critical commercial presence or a world-changing activism site, you cannot tolerate any skullduggery. So go with agoristhosting.com. Have a WordPress or blog site, but you're not satisfied with performance or uptime? Or just want raw hosting? Want to pay with Bitcoin? Agorist Hosting specializes in high-performance hosting with personalized service. Go to agristhosting.com and click on the button that says Get Hosted. That's agristhosting.com.
Freedom Fiends. So we're back. I'm Jeremy. I'm here with Shane.
Hello.
And we're going to get back to something we started talking about in the first hour. See, well, Michael, if you do listen back to this, although, you know, he said he's been listening to the digest lately. So I don't know if you're actually going to hear this part, Michael. Although if Riley's listening, this is a good part, Riley, so you should put this in there. So Michael hears it. We're going to tie up some loose ends from the first hour so we didn't bury the lead back then. So back in the first hour, we had started to talk about the issues of the whole border issue and the so-called open versus closed border debate. And I think Michael had actually brought it up for other reasons, but it had triggered me to start talking about something else because it was a topic I planned on talking about tonight. But what we talked about then briefly, just to rehash, was that it was... There is a debate between people who believe the borders of the United States should be open versus the borders should be closed and, you know, heavily guarded and people kept out and stuff like that. I often get wrongly accused of being for open borders when that is not the case. I am actually for just the abolition of political borders because I would like to see all lands privatized and homesteaded so they can be privatized type of thing. This sparks a lot of controversy in the statist paradigm, but lately, especially in the lead up to the last election and since then, it has become a very, very hotly contested hotly contested topic in the libertarian and anarchist circles as well. Mm-hmm. And I've stayed out of it largely, other than to poke fun at people occasionally. But recently I started getting into it because one of my co-hosts on my other podcast, The Seeds of Liberty, my buddy Andre, started engaging me in conversation about it. And he is actually a lot more level-headed than some of these other people I've dealt with before. So I was willing to engage with him. And he and I actually had some productive conversations about it. We actually even did, after we recorded our podcast the other night, him and I actually stuck around and did an after show that we recorded that I'm going to put out as a Patreon episode at some point soon, where we actually discussed this stuff and got past the whole idea of the, you know, that I necessarily must be for open borders because I don't agree with them, with his position or other people's position, and actually had a conversation about things, because that's where, unfortunately, a lot of it gets shut down, just like so many other things. A conversation gets shut down by people's, you know, like SJW screaming racist or, you know, homophobe or whatever it is, you know, or now it's, you know, leftist, communist, because I've been called a commie. I got called a commie again today. I got told that I should, you know, just, I should stop shaming the yellow and black. And I'm like, first of all, I can't emphasize this enough. I don't know how people keep missing this. I haven't called myself an ANCAP in quite a while. I'm not tarnishing your yellow and black in any way, shape, or form. The fact that my profile picture on Facebook is yellow and black actually has nothing to do with me. The artist who drew that for me used that color scheme and gave it to me, and I happily accepted it because I think it's an awesome picture of me.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that I am touting the yellow and black. So don't get your panties in a bunch there, people. but that I should just admit that I'm a communist, and I still don't understand how I'm a communist and all this. But the larger debate has now become, and I think this actually started, at least I remember seeing it really become a thing, was sometime last year. I think it was towards the middle end of summer, so about a year ago or a little, you know, thereabouts, where there was an article that came out by Lou Rockwell that was actually based on a speech he had given probably at one of the Mises events, although I'm not actually 100% sure about that. But it sounds like something that he would have done at a Mises Circle event or something like that. But it was an article about figuring out what to do with the so-called public property, because, you know, if you're a, you know, a constitutionalist or anybody who actually, you know, believes in the idea of America and the fact that, you know, government is necessary, yada yada, and public property is, you know, it's the we the people stuff. It's like, you know, no, the public property belongs to, you know, it's the people of the country. Everybody owns it. It's collective property. And he, you know, the idea of this article or this speech was, you know, trying to get to the bottom of what's the actual libertarian position on, you know, on public property, because most people say, you know, you instinctively say it's illegitimate because government can't own that. Collective property is nonsense, you know, type of stuff, because, you know, individuals can own property. People can band together and, you know, buy property. But the, you know, the commons, as they were, stuff like this, it's all BS. So he was trying to get to the bottom of this. And the arguments that he came up with were that the taxpayers are the actual owners of all this property because they've been stolen from, which I'm all for, because, you know, as we say quite often on here, taxation is theft, or actually more accurately, portion, as I like to point out,
with that part of it.
Yes. And taxation is absolutely theft. And the fact that, you know, everything government has ever, quote unquote, bought has been with stolen funds, absolutely makes it makes their claim to the property illegitimate. But the argument that got laid out and has now picked up steam since then, and has been worked around, you know, molded around a little bit, but then continued to be pressed, especially by a lot of the seemingly alt-right wing of the anarchist and libertarian movements that has sprung up, there's other people too that are, you know, that are not that hardcore that are also pressing this argument too, that it's, you know, it's to the taxpayers. And as it was pointed out to me recently, although my co-host Andre is the only one who has actually pointed this part of it out to me. Nobody else has mentioned this, so I kind of have a hard time believing that all of them are making the same argument. That, well, it's not an equal share for the taxpayers. You know, obviously some people have paid more in taxes, so some people actually own more of it. But the argument goes that since the taxpayers, however you want to break that down, actually own this because they have the best claim to the property, because since the government stole the property, you know, basically bought it with stolen funds, or acquired it through using stolen funds and stuff like that, like even if it was unowned to begin with, or if they took it through eminent domain or all these things, you know, which again to me seems a little weird, because if anybody has a rightful property claim to government land, any land that was taken through eminent domain, I would think should go back to the rightful owners of, you know, who that land would who actually had a legitimate claim to it to begin with before the government took it.
Do any of those still exist?
Those people, I don't know, but their heirs could possibly exist. And for me, that would be perfectly fine if their family, if it was handed down to their family, that, you know. And again, my co-host didn't have an argument with that, although there is a lot of that land that has been stolen, even recently through eminent, to this day still gets taken through eminent domain. So that stuff could be given back to the quote-unquote rightful owners. That's a decent amount of land. Then there's the stuff that's, you know, because unfortunately, the thing that doesn't seem to get thought about in this argument is the fact that what was a huge amount of the stuff that was taken through eminent domain used for, the roads. So if you want to follow this train of thought through and give it back to all the proper people, okay, but you just lost your roadways.
Right. They're the ones that are always saying, what about the roads?
Yeah. So he and I agreed on that. But again, I haven't seen anybody else bring up this. It's just, well, certain taxpayers have a certain claim to this. You know, they have a higher claim to it. So it's technically their property. Versus the argument that I would make, others, I know others would make, Ben Stone, I know, has made this argument that it's up for homesteading because it's actually nobody, it's right, illegitimately owned, so nobody owns it. But this is the argument going on right now, because and people getting labeled a communist for not agreeing with it, which I think is insane, of course. But yeah. It's this argument that the taxpayers in some hierarchical order, depending on how much they paid, are the rightful owners of these properties. So they can refuse, you know, they have a right to refuse entry to new people who would not be paying in, and not, you know, and all this stuff. And for me, like, right on its face, this takes on so many horrible implications, like what would have to be, and like the mental gymnastics and everything that would be needed to actually have an actual claim of ownership to anything.
It's a logistic and clerical nightmare.
Well, yeah, and which I got yelled at for saying, well, just because it's really hard doesn't mean it's impossible, and doesn't mean it's not, you know, doesn't mean we're not making an ethical argument. And I'm like, yeah, great. Make an ethical argument all you want. I'm sure you could make an ethical argument out of this, that the taxpayers are the rightful owners of this. However, in reality, there's no practical application to your ethical argument, because it can't be done. Number one, it's impossible to figure out exactly how much has been stolen from every one of us, because you're taxed on almost everything you do. Nobody has records of what they were taxed on for everything they do. Right. You could go through income taxes and state income taxes and possibly other bills you've paid taxes on and stuff like that. But large portions of people's purchasing things, like at stores and stuff like that, gas, all these different things, you'll never be able to track what people have actually paid. Right. Number one.
That all just sounds like a bunch of central planning to me.
Well, and, I mean, yeah. I don't even necessarily think that. But I think it would be I say virtually only because I don't like to say anything's impossible because I don't like to use absolutes. But right. It's virtually impossible to actually track what people paid. And even if you could, again, the majority of the people who paid in a lot of it are long since dead. And if you can't find family heirs, then all of a sudden it just gets, and it's the term somebody used with me is, well, it just gets redistributed then. It's like, wait a minute, you're going to redistribute somebody's money, but I'm the communist?
I know, right?
Yeah. Worms. Well, I could talk about this for hours, but we got to get to the market.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Are you sick of seeing peaceful people being locked away for victimless crimes? Instead of trying to get out of jury duty, consider taking it so you can do the right thing. A single juror with a conscience can send someone home to their family instead of to a jail cell. If there's no victim, how can there be a crime? And if the judge or prosecutor are keeping you in the dark, what are they trying to hide? You can vote your conscience instead of being a pawn of the state. For more information, Google jury nullification or check out the Fully Informed Jury Association at fija.org.
Well. So we're back. And last segment, we were talking about the rather tiresome at this point debate about
borders.
What should be done. Yeah, well, borders, and you know, it's more than just the borders, because it's, you know, it's the land itself, whatever government claims land, you know, the property, and who's affected by what, and who actually owns what, and who owns the public property and stuff like that. And you know, we started this off way back in the first hour with Michael saying that he's sympathetic to people who make that argument, and he could see that argument, and people wanting to protect this, you know, and not have anybody else come in and make use of that and devalue it even less effectively. Which, you know, I can see that as far as like the closed borders are clamping down. But for me, and this is where I've apparently drifted away from a lot of my former friends, or some of them are still my friends, but they're not as friendly with me anymore as they used to be, is that I see things more in, and I hate to use the term like in reality, because that's something, you know, everybody used to scoff at, because, you know, that's a common, a rebuttal from people against anarchism, with like, well, here in the real world, or like, we live in reality. It's like, well, no, okay. Right. You know, there are plenty of arguments that can be made, ethical arguments and stuff like that, and arguments for why government is, you know, wrong and all these things that have applications and, you know, can be used into the real world and stuff like that. Not all of them, however, can. And this particular argument, at least as it's been presented to me multiple times now, seems to keep coming down on, you know, this, the fact that it is an ethical argument, which is great, and I'm all for those in a lot of cases, but I've come to realize that ethics really aren't everything, number one. And number two, if there is no practical application to your ethical argument, it's not really much more than mental wanking, honestly.
Right.
Like, it's a huge time waste and a time suck, because what are you going to do with that? You know, like, I mean, as I had been saying in the last segment, you know, if there's stuff that's been taken through eminent domain, if there's stuff that government quote unquote bought through people who voluntarily sold them pieces of land or whatever it is, then, you know, if we follow the train of thought that taxation is theft, and therefore everything government has purchased with that theft is illegitimate, then that would return to the quote unquote rightful owners or their heirs, in my opinion. And I think a lot of people, even the people on the other side of this debate, would agree with that. What's up in question is the stuff that was unowned to begin with. Right. And you know, Ben Stone made a great argument for this, as far as I'm concerned, in his recent book that we, of course, here at the Freedom Fiends completely recommend that you don't read, and we condemn it. You know, it's horrible stuff. You know, never read that book whatsoever. and if you ever do, realize that it's a work of fiction. But made a great argument for the fact that it's unowned property, because it's they had an illegitimate claim from the beginning. So for me, they were, you know, I say it's an illegitimate claim, then I get told that, well, no, if a claim has been made, then somebody has to have a better claim. And it's like, okay, we're following this whole semantic line of thing. Let's change the word to appropriate. I got yelled at for that too. Then I thought of a new one that I hadn't brought up to my co-host, but I'm going to start using it now. Okay, fine. Government's been squatting illegitimately for 200 plus years.
Technically, they have.
On a lot of this property. Because for me, as far as practical applications go, how do you solve this problem with all this property? Well, the simple thing is, if you look at it as the fact that it was illegitimate from the start and nobody actually owns it, then it is up for homesteading, because nobody legitimately owns it. And, you know, all government property should be treated as such. This is not to say that people who have been stolen from aren't owed restitution and don't deserve restitution. But the reality, unfortunately, is just because you're owed things in this world doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get them.
Worms.
And that ties things up a lot neater than having to jump through the insane amount of hoops that it would take to not be able to prove how much money was actually stolen from people in the first place, so that they can be given their slice of a certain amount of property, which everybody would be fighting over the same best property in the first place, which leads to a whole new set of disputes.
Worms.
Keep it simple, stupid.